So the first day of the retreat, the first full day, is behind us. And I hope you're all hanging in. I hope you're all doing okay. I trust that. The first day is not an easy day on retreat. And some of you may be struggling. You may be struggling with the silence or with the lack of choices here, with the austerity, the having to do with just the very bare necessities, the basic needs. And this form of the retreat is not exactly a form that's been arrived at by consensus, by sitting down and talking about it and all of us coming up with something that we agree on. So I'd like to begin by giving some background to this form of retreat and where the form comes from. The retreat is loosely based on the form of Buddhist monastic life. It's a 2,600-year-old tradition with a reason. So monasteries are set up to support calmness and to support insight, which are the two basic aspects of the practice. A teacher that I sit with and have great respect for, Ajahn Viradamo, said being a monk or a nun is like going on a 24-hour retreat for life. So life is one of very conscious simplicity. There's an absence, there's a lack of sensory stimulation to the senses. There's an absence of distractions, and there's an absence of choices. So on retreat, we make a commitment to the five precepts that we talked about last night, and to keep these precepts for the 5 days that we're here together. If you think that's a little bit challenging, the monks make a commitment to approximately 228 precepts, and that's for life. And the nuns have a few more added to that. So I think it's important to know and to acknowledge that this isn't designed, it's not planned to be a punishment. It's not planned to deprive you of anything. But it's a the reason that this grew up was to be a very deliberate, direct cultivation of awareness. This is what supports awareness and mindfulness and clear seeing. So when I thought about how to explain this, what came to mind is actually in the world of nature. Do you know the word camouflage? Carmel taught me this. Hasvaha. Is that close? You know what that is? Okay. So when you talk about camouflage, you refer to an object that's in relationship to its background. So here's the lamp, this is the object, and this is the background. And in nature, animals have coloring, have fur in patterns that are similar to where they live. A butterfly might have the same color or pattern that the flower that it feeds on. And a really obvious example, I don't know if it's true in the Israeli army, but in the U.S. Army, see it in movies all the time, the camouflage suit. It looks like leaves. And that's so the soldier can be protected in the environment. So he can blend in, so he doesn't stand out, so the animal doesn't stand out, or the bird, or the lizard. So with similar colors and patterns, all of these things have an ability to blend into the surroundings, and it provides it all, them all, with a safe hiding place in order to trick its enemy, in order to trick whatever creature wants to pounce on it and eat it. So that's an elaborate way to explain that an object against a very busy background doesn't stand out. So this could be a metaphor for delusion, for not seeing clearly. Our lives are very busy, just like the background of a camouflage. We're busy, we're distracted, and awareness and clear seeing doesn't have a chance to stand out, to show itself in that busy, busy, busy background. When we're busy, we don't notice things. We don't remember things. Have you ever tried to find a set of keys on your desk? At least if your desk looks like my desk. It's really, really hard. It's that old looking for a needle in a haystack. So inner wisdom also is often not heard or not found. The depth of heart not experienced with all the noise in our lives, with all the doing. And so the monastic life kind of strips bare the background. It simplifies life. And it also gives constant reminders to be awake. For monks and nuns, it's a life of study. It's a life of meditation practice, a very precise code of conduct. And add to that a whole calendar of ritual observances, all of which contribute to this simplicity. Very few choices in life. That kind of life of just bare necessity. And with this kind of very simple background, and with perhaps, you know, less choices, the mind activity is simplified, and that essential practice of mindfulness has a chance to thrive. So the structure here on this retreat, on most retreats in this Vipassana tradition, the schedule, the silence, the precepts, all of that is here to support the practice. And these are all similar to the simplicity of the monk's life. So the things that cover up and confuse, these things are lessened. And just like on a monastery here on retreat, the noise, the doing, the talking, the books and the writing, the shopping, the cooking, the telephone, these aren't part of our life here. And the retreat structure replaces these things with that which is intended to clarify, to enlighten, to make clear. The wisdom of the teachings and the actual experience of looking into each moment for ourselves. Clear seeing into the truth of things, into the truth of existence. So the retreat provides the background to see suffering, to see the struggle, to experience the struggle, to experience and see clearly the grasping, the nature of things. It provides a supportive ground to develop calmness and see what effect that has on our life, to develop understanding and see what effect that has on our life. So we use various tools and techniques. There's the silence again, and the practice of mindfulness of the breath, for example. And some of it you may find helpful and some not. None of them is an absolute. There are no claims that this is the way, every time, always, forever guaranteed that this is the way to liberation. These are tools that are offered, and during the week here, during the 5 days, there will be more suggestions and more tools. And it's in our own practice, in our own experience, that we get to see what's helpful. So you have to experience and judge it for yourself over time. So we come on retreat, and we're asked to be mindful. The instructions are to pay attention to the breath, to the actual experience in this moment. It seems like a simple instruction, yes? But perhaps not so easy in the practice. So this is what I'd like to reflect on with you tonight, and hopefully to offer some encouragement. So what is it that usually happens when we come into the meditation hall and we sit here? The attention often goes to how dissatisfied we are with how the breath is. Maybe it feels tight. Maybe it feels too shallow. Or else the dissatisfaction, not being satisfied, can arise with how I am as meditator. Even how I am as breather, as one who breathes. I'm not doing this right. The attention often goes to criticism, to judgment. It can even go to praise. It can go to many, many stories about it. Comparing the breath, or comparing myself, perhaps to another sitting, perhaps to another retreat. Comparing myself to how another meditator seems to be doing in the hall. And the stories, the mind keeps coming up with, oh, it would be easier if. Maybe it would be easier if I didn't eat so much at supper and I could sit here without such a full stomach. It would be easier if I had more experience and then I'd know what I was doing. It was easier last retreat. It was easier last year. Whatever. So what we're asked for is to be present with the experience of the breath. So I sit here, we all sit here, and let's do that for a minute. So what my attention goes to is my heart beating very, very fast, which always happens, not always, but when I sit up here and I'm giving a talk. And it's really very hard for me to even have any sense of the breath. So what is it that happened? There was the intention to be with the breath, but the attention was drawn to another body sensation. Another time, or for some of you, maybe the attention went to a sound happening. Maybe it went to noticing thoughts. At some point during the sitting, awareness wakes up to know what's happening, that the attention is with something other than the breath. If you think about it, that's what the meditation is asking us to do, to know what's happening right now in this moment. The attention is right now with this. For me, it was with the body sensation of the heart beating. And just to let awareness rest with this experience for a moment, and then gently and directly let the awareness, let the attention come back to the experience of the breath. But what so often happens, and I speak from my own experience, as well as listening to you in small groups and having individual meetings with many, many people on retreat, what happens is the attention seems to get captured. It gets captivated by an opinion about what is happening, or a story about what is happening. So maybe it's a story about, or an opinion about, my heart beating. Oh my God, I'm gonna get ill from this. I should never sit up here again and give another talk. If there's pain in the leg, there can be a story about that. If the thinking starts, the one thought leads to another thought, leads to another thought. And very often, this just leads to lots and lots of frustration and more dissatisfaction. And it seems that when we're held hostage by the reaction to what is noticed, the story about that, the story just continues, and the interest stays with the story, and then the reaction, and the reaction to that, and the reaction to that. It just spreads. There's a wonderful word in Buddhism called papancha, and it's that spreading, that one thing, one thought leading to another, to another, to another. And we're miles away into the story, miles away from the awareness of the breath. So these reactions that we often have to just that initial connection. So for me, with my heart beating, or with a thought, or with a pain, and then there's a reaction to it. And the reactions can be very, very strong, especially at the beginning of a retreat, when we're very much in that busy mode, when we haven't settled into the new surroundings. It can really be very upsetting when we come here to meditate, and instead the mind and the body seem to have a different idea. So Norman talked about these reactions that can show themselves so strongly at the beginning of a retreat. He talked about them this morning, and the first one is that dullness. The condition of the body or the mind, it's like being in a fog, a thick fog. That feeling of, I don't want to wake up. I just want to go to sleep. That voice that just says, I can hardly keep my eyes open every time I sit down on a cushion. The real heaviness of body. Have you experienced that feeling of, you sit down and all of a sudden the head just starts drooping, the whole body starts drooping, and then all of a sudden you sort of, somehow, luckily, the body wakes up. It's almost like, do you know pea soup? It's really thick. That's what it feels like to me when it happens. There's no clarity. There's no sense of breath. There's no sense of anything but that dullness and that real strong desire for sleep. And this whole idea of awareness, it doesn't seem to show itself until the sound of the bell. But some of us would be grateful for a little bit of rest on our cushion. Those of us with restless bodies and restless minds. So this state of restlessness can show itself on retreat as those bodies that just can't sit still, that feel the energy racing through us, the bodies that feel itchy and irritated and agitated, a pain here, a pain there, swallowing, coughing, sniffing. And the restlessness shows itself in the mind as well. Thoughts just racing around and dominating awareness. That's all that shows. So often, I have to do this. I didn't do this. I should do this. I must do this. I will do this, or I won't do this. It goes on and on. This restlessness is the mind, the restless mind that sees the retreat as an opportunity for making lists of things that I'll do when I get home. Organizing one's life. I used to go write them down after the sitting because I was sure that I'd never remember them. So it's the state of busyness. And it, do you notice, it's like this restlessness seems to feed the thoughts. And it feeds this busyness and restlessness and agitation. It goes in a cycle. It's like one of those little animals, a hamster on a treadmill. And we just get stuck in the confusion or the anxiety or whatever it is that shows, spinning out the stories and the fears, again leaving awareness of the breath far behind. So when there's this restlessness or sleepiness, especially in the beginning of the retreat, especially for first-timers who don't have the trust that things will change, who don't have the experience yet that things will change, it can feel awful. So what happens next? I don't really like this. I really want it to go away. I really want things to be different. This rejection, this wanting to get rid of, this aversion. This is aversion showing itself. The mind spinning out stories of what I don't like and I want to change, and how to change it. The mind gets very creative with what I can do to change this awful feeling. Or else there's the grasping, the hanging on to something. Well, I have this idea of how things should be. I have this idea of how I should be, and that's what I want. Attached to what I like, attached to the comfortable, attached to the pleasant. This way of the mind of either grasping or pushing away is actually basically one reaction. It's part of the same thing. It's like a pendulum. Do you know what that word is? The pendulum that just swings from side to side. Grasping what I want, aversion for what I don't want. And what's in the middle? What's in the middle of this pendulum swing? It's being okay with how things are. It's not following the mind first here and then there. The aversion can also show itself as anger. And in a way, it's like passing on the dissatisfaction, the unsatisfactoriness, to something else. Or maybe it's passing on disappointment or judgment. Maybe it's to the retreat and how it's being run. Maybe it's to other people sitting in the hall because they're coughing or moving too much. Or maybe it's because they sit too quietly and they make me look bad. Or maybe it's to something for being too much this way or too little that way. This hindrance, this obstacle to mindfulness, anger just spinning out its stories. And then what? At any point in the midst of this restlessness or dullness, in the midst of aversion or the anger or the wanting, doubt can show itself. That's the voice that says, this really isn't good. I shouldn't be doing this. as I'm nodding off for the 10th time today or the 100th time today, the little voice can arise, why am I here? Why did I decide to do this? As I'm captivated by this restless mind, the thought can arise, I have much too much to do at home. Maybe I should leave and do a retreat when I'm not so busy. As I struggle to sit still and the pain in my knee is just too strong, the fear says, this will never get better, and I'm probably doing very serious harm to my body. As I compare how things actually are during the sittings and during the days here with how I wish or how I think they should be, and they fall short of this ideal, doesn't the thought come in, why did I ever come? This really isn't for me. Doubt and more doubt. Again, spinning out the stories and mind states that interfere with awareness. We get just caught in them. So the Buddha had a name for these five reactions, for these five mind states, to these conditions that contribute to lack of clarity and mindfulness, to knowing just what is. He named them the five hindrances. The Buddha liked to make lists of things, and I think because it really is easier to remember that way. So the five hindrances, I'm sure you're very familiar with them, even if you don't know them as that label. Dullness, restlessness, desire, aversion, and doubt. So each of these can be an obstacle, a difficulty to mindfulness, to clear comprehension. But I think a more important question is, do they need to be a hindrance or obstacle to meditation? Does the doubt, or the restlessness, or the sleepiness, does this need to be a hindrance to meditation, to what we're doing here? And the answer is a clear, resounding no. They are the meditation. They may hinder understanding. They may cause us frustration. They might make mindfulness difficult. But they do not have to be a problem to what we're doing here. These states just become the meditation itself, to be met, to be experienced, to be befriended. They are the meditation itself. So in cultivating awareness of what is, regardless of whether there's dullness or restlessness or doubt, or wanting things to be different. In the opening to what is, the particular state doesn't have to get stuck by the struggle with it, by this swinging from one end of the pendulum to the other, or by our dissatisfaction with it. Opening to it, whatever it is, whatever is showing in any moment, allows it to just have its life and pass away. Seeing the swing and not giving it a push allows the pendulum to come to rest. This is awakening to life just as it is, right now. Waking up to what we notice, waking up to what our experience is. receptivity to what is. In my experience, this receptivity, this willingness to allow, this willingness to open to, is a key to this process, is a key to what we're doing here. The allowing what we feel, what we experience, what we think, what we hear, just to be a receptacle, a container, to hold what is, but not to grasp or hold on to or to tighten around. Just allowing the presence of, acknowledging. And how we do this is so important. Can this allowing be a softening to what is, which is so different from being a detached observer, or from being critical or judgmental. The name Buddha means awakened one, one who is awake. And this practice is to wake up, to experience and to know what is gently and carefully and tenderly. You might ask why. Norman mentioned this before. It's for calmness and for insight, for understanding. With calmness and steadiness, awareness has a chance to come alive. Understanding has a chance to arise. Actually, and this may seem very, almost like a paradox, when one experiences one or many of the hindrances that often come during a retreat, this can be an opportunity. Can be an opportunity to see into what may be the conditions that have contributed to their arising. These conditions, these factors, aren't separate from us, aren't separate from whatever comes. The environment, the emotions, the mind and the body all affect each other. We all know this. They're interdependent. Dependent on conditions. So seeing this interdependence of life, this is understanding into the nature of things. And so it's understandable that with the stress and the anxiety in our lives, when we come here and we sit down, we slow down, we stop the talking, we stop the doing, and in the silence and the space here, stuff is going to come, stuff is going to show itself. And on the cushion, we're sitting here and we notice it. We notice the tiredness. We experience the emotions. We experience the body and the mind moving restlessly. So with all these states, the important thing is to see them as just what's happening. And to meet them. To meet yourself with acceptance and with softness. And knowing and understanding this conditionedness, this conditionality of things, of life, the Buddha said, that being, this is. With the understanding of this, maybe we can let go of needing the sense of our meditation to always be peaceful and calm. Because how can it possibly be that way? Doesn't the meditation in any moment arise out of conditions? Conditions of the present, conditions of the recent past. You know, one of the factors that probably has a strong impact on us here, how we're sitting and how the meditation is the state of the heart and mind that is affected by the political turmoil and the fear here in Israel. How can this not be a factor? Our meditation can also be affected by conditions that we don't even see or know. Any sitting can be dependent on so many things: the weather, our health, what we eat, what views we hold, how we slept last night, what we did yesterday or last week, or even perhaps when we were 3 years old. Affected by events in our daily life and by events in the world. So where's the freedom in always needing the meditation or anything in our life to be a certain way? Can there be freedom with that? If our happiness or our sense of peace or fulfillment is dependent on something that will inevitably change or come to an end, how can it be more than just temporarily satisfying? If I need my meditation to happen in a quiet meditation hall in order for me to be at peace, or if I decide that focusing the breath with real ease all the time is the way that I consider mindfulness, that's my measure of mindfulness, how I judge if I'm mindful, or if having a comfortable cushion is essential for understanding. With all of these requirements, if the meditation is dependent on them or on factors beyond my control, a lot of dissatisfaction arises. This is the grasping mind. This is aversion mind at work here. The judging mind, the critical mind. And this just leads to endless rounds of frustration, of struggle, of disappointment. So the meditation practice is about taking time, about being quiet and being awake to what is, softening to what is, regardless of the feeling, regardless of how we feel about it. The Buddha's teaching is to recognize and know this experience of dissatisfaction, to know the experience of struggle. And in his language, he called this dukkha, suffering, as it's often translated. To recognize dukkha as it's happening, not theoretically, not as an idea, but as it arises, as we experience it in the body or in the mind. And here on retreat, when we see the dukkha arise, oh, I'm a terrible meditator, or the food is awful, or I wish I brought warmer clothes or cooler clothes, or my roommate is noisy, or the pain in the knee is keeping me from meditating. Okay, here's your chance. Here's your chance to really know dukkha, and to know that you know. Here's my chance. Get familiar with it. Allow the experience of it, gently. Because the Buddha taught to end dukkha, to end the struggle, you must first know it. You must know it and understand it. And the understanding is that it arises because we try to get rid of it. We try to push it away, reject it. We try to hide from the unpleasant, from what we don't like. Or we long for, or we try to keep the pleasant, what we like, what we desire. So here in the sitting, a meditation shows us where we grasp and where we push away, and it shows us the results of this grasping and aversion. The results being the struggle, the judgment, the frustration, the dukkha. So being aware of this and looking into it with interest and with calmness is what the practice of awareness is all about. So this word practice, which in Hebrew is tirgul, yes? What does it mean? I think it holds clues for us. So it makes me think of music practice. You know, how many of us had instruments that we played and had to practice as children? So this word practicing, it means to perform or to work at repeatedly so as to become skilled. It's to do something enough so that we don't have to think about it. It's to apply oneself. This repeating something to become good at it. And to me, this speaks of practice as a training, as a path. And this mindfulness is a training. And often the language of the Buddha refers to it as a path. And this also suggests to me that the practice is a foundation on which the training rests. There's a discourse of the Buddha with the name Foundations or Applications of Mindfulness, and it's called the Satipatthana Sutta. And the practice that we do here is based on that. So the name of this sutta holds some clues, and Norman mentioned this, I think this morning. Sati meaning mindfulness, giving careful attention or remembering, and patana meaning application. So it's about practicing so that mindfulness just becomes the norm. So we remember to be mindful, so we remember to be aware. And the word application says to me, this is how to use the mindfulness. This is the Buddha's guidance on how to use mindfulness, not just of anything. He pointed out four things to be mindful of. The body, and that's what we're doing with mindfulness of the breath and mindfulness of walking and standing. He also included mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of the teachings. And that's what we're doing right now, paying attention to the teachings. And it also says that this guidance is to be used, it's to be applied. It's not just to be listened to or read about, but really to be applied. It's an action word. So when you bring the two together, the practice is about applying mindfulness, applying careful attention, wakefulness, alertness, interest in a very conscious way, and what we're doing today to the experience of the breath. So just to convey that this is not a passive thing. It's not just sitting back, but there's an attention. When I'm taking a walk, I can be aware of a butterfly out of the corner of my eye. And at the same time, I can also notice other sights. I can see things, I can notice sights, I can notice sounds, I can hear the birds, and I can even notice that there's thinking happening. So there's the butterfly at the same time as I'm noticing other things happening. It's allowing the butterfly to be present and to stand out in the noticing. It's mindfulness. So if we think of that in terms of the breath, what's being asked for? It's to allow mindfulness of it. The in-breath, the out-breath, the shallowness of it perhaps, the depth of it, the ease or the resistance. And it also means knowing the experience of what else may be arising at the same time. The thoughts or the feelings or sensations, but letting them recede in importance. Not pushing them away, but giving the importance instead to the experience of breathing. And this whole idea of being on a path, I really find comfort in knowing this. That the way is shown, but we must walk it for ourselves. We must take the steps. We have to practice. The Buddha is asking us to use experience as teacher instead of theory or even taking his word for it. So this practice that we do is forgiving. There's no need to judge or to criticize. There's no need to compare. This is a training, an intention. It's not a command. There need be no punishment if the mindfulness finds a different object than the breath. Or if we forget to remember, or if we forget to be mindful. Hopefully, we'll remember the encouragement just to begin again and again and again. I just want to talk about one other thing just for a minute, because I think it's important, and that is, how do we use what we do here in daily life? So what I've seen and come to know for myself is that bringing mindfulness and interest to the breath, to the body, to just what's happening in each moment without the grasping or aversion, what I see is that there can actually be a slowing down of the habitual patterns of reaction in my life. Enough to recognize the habits and to bring awareness to them. To let the awareness rest with them in a steady and calm way. And the mindfulness has a calming effect. When it's steady, it also illuminates. It shows things clearly. So when I slow down enough to see and know what's happening, like in an argument, when that's happening, it's like stepping outside the force of a storm. It's like stepping into the eye of the storm where there's quiet and peacefulness enough to really see and know what's happening. To see the taking up of views. To see the taking up, the grasping, the importance of me. This is not avoidance or denial, but it's like stepping in with new eyes. So that this, I can see habit as habit and not necessarily a wise response. So when I step outside of this force of habit and responding from the past, a new response is possible. There can be just an allowing a response to come, allowing wisdom to show itself arising from this moment. And not from the past reactions or past hurts. So instead of reaction from a place of anger or resentment, instead of reaction to what is perceived as my pain or my fault or doing the wrong thing, instead, with awareness and interest, understanding and wise action is possible. So if I notice criticism happening, just opening to and allowing the experience of that in the body and in the mind, just allowing it to be felt and to be known. It's just mind being mind, or body being body. The same is true with self-judging. Just know the experience of that. Knowing doubt or anger or fear, just opening and allowing the direct experience of it. Knowing it as just what mind does. Just what mind does. Knowing discomfort in the body. Knowing it as body being body. Not passively, not intellectually, but bringing attention to the physical, the actual physical experience of it, not the stories about it. And doing so with receptivity and with kindness. This practice of mindfulness can be a powerful support for nonviolence and non-suffering on many levels. Nonviolence to myself and to others, a powerful support to the non-suffering of myself, to the non-suffering of others, to the health of the body, and to the profound opening of the heart. This mindfulness practice can be a contribution to peace in the world. So let's sit quietly together for a few moments.